as you can hold your breath. And you went to different cities. And gosh, how many people ended up fainting at these readings?
You know, in the first year, I quit counting once we reached a total of 73. And that was just 1 year out of several years I read that story. The most was in Brighton, at the Brighton Fringe Festival. I was in this enormous hall that held 800 or 900 people, and 18 people fainted when I read the story. And then most recently, I read it at a synagogue, of all places, in Washington, D.C., this historic, I believe it's called the I Street Synagogue, and 5 people fainted. And I ended the story with colored lights, the ambulance lights, reflecting off the stained glass windows as the ambulances arrived for these 5 people who had passed out. And I have no idea. It is, at this point, hundreds of people have fainted.
I wonder, though, with all of your one-upsmanship on yourself, on pushing the limits of prose, of horror and satire, if you can keep up with the zeitgeist, if you can keep up with the politics now. People are saying that satire is dead, that the pronouncements coming out of the White House are becoming indistinguishable from headlines in The Onion or The Daily Show.
You know, but there's always people to listen to. And when I'm at parties, my job is not to talk. I spend most of my time just listening to people, and I hear them tell the most amazing, funny, secret things that just aren't in the culture yet. And I think the secret of my success is to always find these unexpressed things and bring those to the market.
Yeah, you've become kind of a mentor to younger writers, and you're getting these stories out of your head, these transgressional stories, as you call them, has really helped people come up to you and confess, like you're a clergy member, like you're a priest, and they bring you all of these amazing, weird, tragicomic stories.
They do, and also, it doesn't just give them permission to tell the stories. It also, you know, I hope, creates a kind of sort of shocking clearing in their life where they realize that the world is not as cut and dried and not the finished thing that they think it is. Yeah, there was one example. I was at the dollar store. I was at the dollar store in the Hollywood District, and I hope this man will forgive me, but there was a young man in a really styling coat. He was a fantastic overcoat with a stand-up collar. And I noticed the coat, and then I noticed the man appeared in every aisle I was in. And finally he approached me, and he said, "I hope you don't mind my saying hello, but I was at your adult storytelling event that you did at Broadway Books." And that was a time when I was first experimenting with this adult storytelling form where the audience was invited to come in their pajamas. And I would read with Chelsea Kane, and I would read with Lydia Yuknovich and Monica Drake, and we would wear our pajamas. And I was also ordering these huge cases of oversized carnival stuffed animals from the Littman Company. So the first 50, 100 people in line would get these enormous giraffes or penguins or lions.
The famous party store in Portland.
Right. And these were so huge that they dwarfed the adults holding them and made people look even more childlike. But this young man in the dollar store, he said, "I went to your event. I was standing in line. My brother had died the day before. And I wasn't closer to anyone in the world than I was to my brother. And I was so devastated by his death. I was just on autopilot. And I had tickets for your event. So I just went because I didn't know what to do. And I was standing there outside Broadway Books with all these people, and you walked up and you gave me an enormous stuffed penguin that was almost as big as I was. And the moment was so ridiculous that I realized that the world still held some surprises and things that I couldn't anticipate, a joy that I could not conceive of at that moment was still possible. And that penguin, that ridiculous, stupid gesture, gave me what I needed to keep moving forward in my life. And I just want to thank you for that." And so I think that rather than shocking people, the objective is always to kind of present something that so amazes them that it makes them aware that the world holds far more surprises, far more joy than they could ever anticipate in the current moment.
What a liminal moment.
And you know what I said? I said, dude, that is a great looking coat. Where'd you get that coat? Because I didn't know what to say.
What you said just reminds me of some of the temple carvings you'll see in old Buddhist temples and Hindu temples, sometimes in Mesoamerican temples, that are just scenes of horror, of dismemberment, of the worst kinds of deaths and afterlives. And the idea that the terrible and the sacred can be flip sides of each other, there can be that portal there.
And that is so much how humor or ecstasy works, is it the idea is you create this enormous amount of tension, and you add to that tension, and you just build that tension. And then as quickly as possible, you try to resolve that tension. And the faster you can resolve that enormous built-up tension, the greater the relief will be, and people will respond with ecstasy or with laughter. And so, you know, that's always the goal, is to keep building tension and then to resolve the tension very, very quickly so that people feel that big rush of ecstasy.
You're listening to Between the Covers. I'm S.W. Konser, and my guest today is author, journalist, and graphic novelist Chuck Palahniuk. His latest book, just out from Dark Horse Comics, is Legacy, an off-color novella for you to color. Did you ever see the Jim Jarmusch movie, Only Lovers Left Alive?
No, sorry.
Oh, yeah, it was these two vampires were on opposite sides of the world, one in Detroit and one in Morocco and Marrakesh. And the whole idea was that being immortal just gets so damn tedious. So one of the characters is looking for a way out, and he has a bullet crafted from hardwood that will pierce his heart. But that same energy really comes into the story and legacy, that you've got these characters who are immortal, and it can be a real drag. It can really destroy your personality.
Well, and that's part of the reveal I don't want to go to yet.
Okay.
But when you're young, you know, your youth, your vitality, your appearance is really your source of power. And so I think immortality is especially attractive to young people because they can't conceive of a form of power more effective than youth and beauty. But as you age, you see that that immortality is a lot less attractive.
Before Fight Club, before even Invisible Monsters, you were working as a journalist, and you're still writing nonfiction pieces for newspapers and magazines. Were you a fan of the new journalism of the 1970s, where writers like Tom Wolfe and Hunter S. Thompson would really immerse themselves in the stories they were covering?
You know, I think initially I was. But like any new style, it gets picked up and it gets practiced by people who aren't as good at it. And so that kind of gonzo journalism that was as much about the journalist as about the topic became so self-conscious that I really got sick of it. I would read these articles in magazines where the first 6 or 7 column inches of this nonfiction article is about the writer choosing the right color of necktie and all the factors that are going into getting dressed for the interview. And I would be so annoyed by that it really soured me on this gonzo journalism.
There's a collection that you put together, Stranger Than Fiction, True Stories. Is there a thread that links those together? Are you still happy with that book?
You know, I'm happy with parts of that book. There was a lot of pressure at the time from my editor to do a collection of nonfiction because I'd enjoyed so many of Joan Didion's collections of essays.
Right.
And my editor really wanted that book. And I wish I'd had 20 years to write that book instead of 2 or 3 years. It would have been a much better book.
Would you like to redo it, maybe with some new material?
No, you know, Nora Ephron has done that. She had that fantastic book, Crazy Salad Plus Nine, where she used the very best essays from her collection, Crazy Salad, and she added nine fresh essays. But I don't see that happening. You know, I nonfiction is okay, but fiction and comics are a lot more fun.
Well, last time you were here, you said, so much of my writing is actually a kind of field study, talking to people and looking for what they're upset about. I'm much more of a Studs Terkel than I am a Faulkner.
You know, I'm always finding some aspect of human experience, and then I take it to a party and I tell this one anecdote that I've heard. And if it's a good story, it will evoke other stories, very similar stories. Because when people tell stories in a social setting, it's almost like they're laying out their hands of cards in a game. Oh, that happened to me once, but a better version. And then people will escalate.
One upsmanship.
Exactly. And so you see the same basic anecdote escalate based on other people's lives. But you're seeing the same basic dynamic demonstrated in more and more entertaining, dramatic, upsetting ways. So my job is to take an anecdote. For example, I was on tour a couple years ago, and I was in Los Angeles, and the publicist taking me to the event, as we were driving through the Hollywood Hills, she said friends of hers had just bought this very modern house, you know, cantilevered over the canyon, and it had this very minimalistic fireplace where gas jets made blue flames dance over this bed of crushed white granite. But they couldn't understand why every winter the house stunk really bad. It just stunk to high heavens. They were almost ready to move away. And then a neighbor had stopped by and said, did you know the previous owners had had a cat? And apparently this cat, for years, had been defecating in this crushed white gravel in the fireplace as a cat box. And so that every winter when they flipped the switch and they set the gas jets ablaze, they were basically parboiling all of this cat poop in their living room. It's a great story, but I would tell that story and people would tell me very similar stories that were even worse. And then ultimately in Seattle, someone told a story about some friends of theirs who'd flipped the switch at the moment, unknown to them, that the cat was actually in the fireplace relieving itself. And this blazing cat has shot around the house and set their living room on fire. And it's a classic animal burning the house down story. David Sedaris tells this story with a burning mouse in the pile of leaves. Mark Richard told this story with his short story Strays. But it's such an archetype story that I knew that by collecting all the versions of the cat in the fireplace story that I'd heard from dozens of people, that I'd kind of baited from them using the one event I'd heard of in Hollywood, that eventually it built the story, but it built it from the experience of like 100 people's lives. And that's kind of what I do in that Studs Terkel sort of harvesting way.
The archetype of the blazing animal.
The archetype of the animal that burns the house down is a classic form of short story.
I'm going way back here, but there was a TV series in the 80s, 90s called Northern Exposure. And there was a sociologist who was from a Northwestern indigenous nation who went around collecting the stories of the Anglo people in the community. And they were all urban legends. And he was looking for something transformational in these stories. And there never was a moral or a transformational moment. They were just these weird urban legends, like the Mexican rat.
The Mexican pet.
The Mexican
Chihuahua
pet.
Turns out to be a rat. Yeah.
Yes.
But if you look at them in a kind of Carl Jung way, where you're not looking for them to actually dictate, they typically talk about something more profound than a real sort of cautionary tale. To demonstrate how old I am, back in the 70s, there was a series of books, eventually a movie, and I think they were called The Prometheus Syndrome. And they were about an ecological disaster where a coal mine had released this species of deep subterranean cockroach that could actually rub its back legs together and create sparks. And these cockroaches were free, and they infested American cities, and they began to set buildings and houses on fire. So suddenly we had these fire-starting cockroaches in everyone's house. End of story. So again, we've got the animal. You know, is there always a kind of story about doing wrong to nature. They're always about some cruelty to an animal, and the animal ultimately having its revenge by destroying your life.
You're listening to Between the Covers. I'm S.W. Conser, and my guest today is author, journalist, graphic novelist, and provocateur extraordinaire Chuck Palahniuk. His latest book, just out from Dark Horse Comics, is Legacy, an off-color novella for you to color. Somewhere I saw that you said that you're just fascinated by archetypes, particularly trickster characters like Loki, Hermes, and Coyote. And these are all characters, especially Coyote, the Southwest indigenous trickster, who constantly get killed. And yet, you know, maybe one part of them will remain and they'll come back to life and they'll learn nothing from their horrible experience, but they'll just go on doing whatever they did before.
Yeah, and so much of that is based on reading Lewis Hyde. He had a fantastic book called Trickster Creates the World, or Trickster Makes the World. That's a great book. And it's also his book, The Gift. Both of those books have had a lot of impact on my work.
Right, you said, and because Tyler Durden was always a trickster, I wanted to give him eternal status among the gods.
Right, and I wanted to, in the same way that the tree in Legacy is traced back as a possession through all the previous generations of this man's life, every one of his ancestors has possessed this tree. In Fight Club 2, we find out that every one of the narrator's ancestors has had a relationship with Tyler. And the Tyler has, in a way, groomed them all to create the narrator who would be the ultimate sort of recipient of Tyler's mission.
Yes, in Fight Club 2, the narrator, I believe in Fight Club 2 of the comic series, he's known as Sebastian. In the past, he's been Jack and Joe and who knows what all. But he's now married to Marla Singer. And Marla and the narrator are supposedly settled down. He's got a job at a military contractor. But neither of them are really settled down. Marla wants Tyler Durden back. And the narrator, to some extent, does too. And they have a son. And the story gets into territory ripped from today's headlines. Some really serious terrorism stuff played for comic effect in places.
Boy. You know, and I never think of myself as comic. I think that people don't know how to label it, so it gets labeled as comic because it is so tragic. So many of the elements are fantastically sad. And whenever I work in a medium, I really want to play to the strengths of that medium, so that there are things in Fight Club 2 that are so enormously sad that they could not be made literal enough to be shot as a movie. If you made an army of dying children, an army of children who all had progeria, the advanced aging disease, then you couldn't make that in a movie. It would be so overwhelmingly sad, it could never be done in a movie. But in comics, you have that wiggle room where it can be presented in such a way that people feel an emotional distance from it. And it's not so overwhelmingly tragic that you can't read the story that includes that element. So, you know, that's the glory of comics. It's like a movie, but it's a movie in which you can do things that you could never do in a movie. They're not necessarily sad, and they're definitely not funny. So they kind of occupy that incomplete place, that undecided place, which I think Jacques Derrida would love, the undecided thing that people are always going to have to argue about. Boy, that's why abortion, so many of my stories include some element of abortion, because it is that enormous undecided social issue that will never be resolved and will always generate sort of a feeling of uncomfortableness and you know, in conflict.
That's both a benefit and a curse to the comics form, that people take it as being more lighthearted than other ways of communicating a story.
And ultimately, you don't want people to get it the first time through. You don't want them to get everything. You want them to be able to read this over and over. And then ultimately, you want them to have to take it to other people. There was a sociologist named Shirley Bryce Heath, and she said, what makes a book a classic is when it creates a community of people who have to come together in order to understand the book. And so that's why so many of the Tolkien books are classics, because they've created this community of people who really love to come together and discuss them. And so you want to present a story that is so funny or so tragic or so undecidable that people have to go to one another and say, will you read this? Because I want to talk about this. I'd really like you to read this. So many people I know take my books and say, I met my wife because she read your books and I read your books, and we connected over this thing we both needed to discuss. So in comics or novels or anything, you don't want it to be completely consumable in the first pass. You want people to have to consume it over and over, and then to consume it in the company of other people. And that's what will keep it alive.
I love that you name-check Jacques Derrida, the linguist who was this professor of semiotics who loved to take apart language to argue whether words actually had intrinsic meaning. And I have to wonder, I don't remember Derrida ever having anything to say about comics.
But he did talk, his favorite metaphor was the zombie, and to some extent, lesser extent, the vampire, because the zombie represented for him the ultimate undecided thing. It wasn't alive and it wasn't dead. And so all zombie narratives are about resolving the zombie and making it a dead thing. It's a dead thing, but it presents as a live thing. So it has to be resolved. Same thing with a vampire. And so that was his metaphor for how Western culture was so binary. And it really always sought to resolve the thing that was unresolved.
Have you read the book The Serpent and the Rainbow by Wade Davis?
No, I've seen the movie, that's all.
Yeah, the Sam Raimi movie. The book is fascinating because he traveled to Haiti and met the priests who would zombify people. Basically, he was looking for a medication that would allow medical patients to be anesthetized. Well, the zombie potion was useless for that, but it slowed down heart rates. It allowed people to look dead for a period of time. But when they came back, the people of the community would not recognize them as living people. And that was what turned them into zombies, was that they were no longer considered living people in their own community.
Interesting. You know, because so much of my work is sort of about dramatizing Victor Turner, his work about liminal rituals, where, for example, in Honeymoon, the honeymoon is that period where the couple is married in front of their peers, but then they have to leave their community for a period of time. And once they come back to their community, they're received back as this completely different thing. Similar to once the zombie is removed as a zombie, once it comes back, it will always be the zombie. Once you come back from the limnoid or the liminal ritual, then you will always be the new thing.
That's like the hero's journey, where the protagonist has to leave and be challenged before coming back altered.
There you are. He's doing the same thing over and over.
Well, before we go, I want to make sure to name check Tom Spanbauer again. When you were in the studio last time, you talked about the writing workshops hosted by Tom Spanbauer, Portland's Dean of Dangerous Writing. You and Monica Drake were Tom's original students, and the workshops just grew from there.
Yeah, we were. You know, and there was four of us sitting around Tom's kitchen table, paying him $20 a week. And it was a fantastic time. It was, it made me a writer. Tom's not teaching right now. He quit a couple of years ago because of health problems. But beginning this winter, I'll be teaching with Lydia Yuknovich.
Oh.
She and I are going to be running as close as we can to Tom's workshop, but out of her new offices downtown. She runs a program called Corporeal Writing, and that's Lydia Yuknovich.
Yeah, she was just at Wordstock. She was a big draw. Well, you said that Tom's theory was that the writing itself should be therapeutic. It should allow you to exhaust your feelings around a frightening, unresolved personal issue.
Right. And the idea of exploring the issue and exaggerating the issue and making it as awful as it could possibly be, and then exhausting your emotional reaction to it. That typically, that by the time you were done with the story of the book, the issue was completely resolved. It's amazing how once your emotional attachment to it is gone, the issue just vanishes.
Yeah, it's good to hear that you're teaming up with Lydia Yuknovich. I mean, that sounds like a redoubtable team there.
You know, we're kind of good cop, bad cop. Lydia is very nurturing and very supportive, and I'm very like John Houseman in The Paper Chase. I am a horrible teacher. I am brutal. And so we make a very good cop, bad cop.
Well, I think some people would argue with that. I mean, you've been posting essays for the past decade or more about the craft of writing on your site, The Cult, as well as the sister site, Lit Reactor. And in fact, you've been really encouraging fans. There's a collection of fan-written stories that you compiled in the anthology Burnt Tongues.
And it's funny because most of those essays that I put out there have been compiled and are now being used illegally at Columbia University as a textbook. Friends of mine in the television and writing programs there have sent me pictures of this textbook that is basically downloaded and Xeroxed and sold to students at Columbia.
Oh, they're not even bothering to just get the PDF. They're Xeroxing these days.
Yeah, it's sad. It's but what the hell? You know, maybe someday I'll do a writing book and make a real thing.
So you're kind of not willing to go to the trouble of doing a cease and desist letter.
Well, but it's also kind of a slippery slope because Tom Spanbauer learned so many of these techniques and the terminology from Gordon Lish at Columbia, when Lish was really the Captain Fiction, the Esquire editor and the Knopf editor, and everyone wanted to write like Raymond Carver. And so Tom took Gordon's method and sort of added his own ideas to it, and that's what he taught us. And so much of the terms like horses and burnt tongue were developed by Gordon Lish. So it's really hard for any one person to lay claim to this terminology and to all these techniques when they are compiled from so many other people.
In a way, it sounds like that legacy of writing is like the tree in Legacy. It keeps getting handed down. It sheds its leaves. It grows new fruit. And it goes on from hand to hand, generation to generation.
And you're always looking for someone who will become the custodian and sort of take care of this thing and preserve this thing and pass it down to the next person.
Like the tree that goes through, 50 generations before the fruit ripens.
Right, before somebody else gets a career out of it.
Well, the book is Legacy, an off-color novella for you to color, featuring art by Steve Morris, Mike Norton, Duncan Fregretto, and Nate Picos. The author is Chuck Palahniuk. Chuck, thanks so much for joining us in the studio today.
Thank you very much.
Now, for our listeners who want to keep up with all of your projects, how can they find out more? We mentioned The Cult, the official fan site at chuckpalahniuk.net. You should probably spell that.
Boy, you know, that's the best thing is the cult site. And it's Chuck Palahniuk, PALAHNIUK.net.
And litreactor.com is good too.
Lit Reactor, the teaching site.
You've been listening to Between the Covers on KBOO. I'm your host, SW Conser. You can find an archived version of the show later today at kboo.fm/betweenthecovers. Thanks to Ken Jones for his recording assistance, and to David Hyde and Scott Alley for their promotional help. And thanks to everyone for tuning in today.
revois la ville en fête et en délire, suffoquant sous le soleil et sous la joie. Et j'entends dans la musique les cris, les rires qui éclatent et rebondissent autour de moi. Et perdu parmi ces gens qui me bousculent, étourdi, désemparé, je reste là. Quand soudain je me retourne, il se recule et la foule vient me jeter entre ses bras. Emporté par la foule qui nous traîne, nous entraîne, écrasés l'un contre l'autre, nous ne formons qu'un seul corps. Et le flot sans effort nous pousse enchaîner l'un et l'autre, et nous laisse tous deux épanouis, enivrés et heureux. Entraînés par la foule qui s'élance et qui danse une folle farandole, nos deux mains restent soudées. Et parfois soulevés, nos deux corps enlacés s'envolent et retombent tous deux épanouis, enivrés et heureux.
To KBOO, Portland.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy jueves 16 de septiembre del 2021.